Chapter 4, Lyria, Welcome to the Worlds. Sky. That's what my Da would call the roof of stone and metal that stretched over our home in the mine of Lagolos. It's what we all used to call it, going back generations of our clan to the first pioneers. The sky be crumbling, the sky needs reinforcing. It stretched over us like a great shield, keeping us safe from the fabled Martian storms raging outside. There were dances for the sky, songs wishing it luck and blessings. I even knew two lasses named for it. But the sky wasn't a shield. It was a lid, a cage. I was 16 years of knobby knees and freckles when I first saw the true sky. Took 6 years from the death of the Sovereign on Lunar for the Rising to push the last of the Golds off our continent of Cimmeria. 2 more years for them to finally free our mind from the Grey Warlord who set up his own little kingdom in their absence. Then the Rising came to Lagolos. Our saviors looked more like manic laurel-tied jesters than soldiers draped with trophies of grey and blonde hair and iron pyramid badges. Sling blades and spiked red helmets were painted on their chests, and standing at their front was a weary, bearded red man old enough to be a grandfather. He had a large gun in one hand and in the other a tattered white flag with the 14-pointed morning star. He wept when he saw the bloated bellies and skeletal evidence of our starvation under the Grey Warlord. His gun dropped to the floor, and though he was a stranger to us, he came forward and hugged me. "Sister," he said. Then he hugged the man beside me. "Brother." 4 weeks later, kind-faced men and women wearing white helmets and 14-pointed stars on their chests took us to the surface. I'll never forget their eyes. They were yellow and brown and pink. They had bottles of water, sparkling sweet drinks and candy for the children. And they gave us clunky goggles marked with winged feet to cover our cave eyes from the sun. I didn't want to wear the goggles, rather look at the true sky and its sun with my own eyes. But a kind yellow nurse told me I might lose my sight, so on they went. When the doors of the lift opened, we walked from a basin littered with ships, up metal stairs and out onto an endless plain of tall grass vibrating with the sound of insects. And I saw it. Blue and vast, so large I felt I was falling up into it. The true sky. And there, hanging like a sullen coal on the impossible horizon, was the sun, giving us warmth, filling my eyes with tears, so small I could block it with a thumb. Our sun. My sun. The Republic's relief ships arrived the next morning to bawdy choruses hurled out from the throats of young gallants and lasses. The ships were cleaner than anything I'd ever seen, white as my nephew's baby teeth as they coasted down. On their bellies blazed the Star of the Republic. To us, then, the star meant hope. "Rapa's compliments," a young soldier said as he handed me a chocolate bar. "Welcome to the Worlds, lass. Welcome to the Worlds." On the shuttle away from our mine, a video appeared before each of us, the hologram so lifelike I thought my fingers would touch the gold face that sprung into the air. I'd seen her before, but here above ground on one of her ships, she seemed like a goddess from one of our songs. Virginia, the Lion Heart. Her eyes a terrifying gold, her hair like spun silk held back from her poreless face. She shone brighter than the little coal of a sun, making me feel little more than a shadow of a girl. Child of Mars, welcome to the worlds, the young sovereign began gently. You are about to embark upon a great journey to your rightful place upon the surface of the planet your ancestors built. Your sweat, your blood, and that of your kin gave this planet life. Now it is your turn to share in the bounty of mankind, to live and prosper in this new solar republic and pave a way for the next generation. My heart is with you. The hopes and dreams of people everywhere rise with you. Good luck, and may you and yours find joy under the stars. That was 2 years and 1,000 broken promises ago. Now, under a boiling sun, I hunch over the scant, piddling river beyond Assimilation Camp 121. My back bent and fingers crooked as I rub an abrasive brush into a pair of pants soiled by Ava's work in the slaughter yards where she kills cattle to fill our pot. My arms, once ashen brown like most from Logalos, are wiry and now baked dark by the sun and bitten ragged by the bugs that rise up out of the riverbed mud. The summers of the Sumerian plains are humid and thick with mosquitoes. I swat three away that have found a gap in the lighter flower paste. I'm 18 now, with stubborn baby fat in my cheeks. My hair leaps from my head at a thick tangle, like a rabbit animal trying to escape my skull. I don't blame it. Eyes never rest long on me. The boys on Dad's drill team used to call me Mudbug for the colour of my eyes. Da always said Ava's got the looks in our family. I've just got the temper. Along the riverbank are hard-packed men and women, 20 gammas of my clan humming the ballad of Bloody Mary the Fool. My mother used to hum it as she worked. Rust-red hair bursts from under broad-brimmed hats and head wraps of bright cloth. Off the bank, fishermen lays on boats smoking tobacco as they drag their nets farther into the river. Lambda doesn't let us use the Solar Republic washers in the centre of the camp anymore. Bastards think they have the right, since they are the same clan as the Reaper. Never mind that they're as related to him as I am to bats that come out of the jungle at night to hunt for the camp's mosquitoes. The Solar Republic ships don't come much anymore without a full military escort, what with the Red Hand marauders running mad in the south. Those that do come drop the supplies in little parachute crates from the sky. And the soldiers who actually land in the camp now cradle weapons instead of candy. We see it on the HC news every day. Red Hand raids on helpless camps. Sons kidnapped. Fathers killed. And the rest savaged. They claim they're bringing justice to my clan, the Gammas, for being the pets of our former oppressors. In every camp they raid, they purge us like a strain of diseased rats. Ava believes the Republic will stop the Hand, that the Reaper will come with his howling legions and smite the bastards right and good, or some such. She's always been a pretty fool. The Sovereign brought us out of the dirt and forgot us in the mud. The Reaper hasn't even been to Mars in years. Got more to worry about than his own colour, it seems. Bitten ragged by the mosquitoes, I haul the basket up onto my head and make my way to the camp. The pawing electricity of a coming storm fills the air. In the distance, across the green-stained savanna, huge thunderheads begin to bruise the sky purple and black. They're forming fast. Heaps of trash hump the violent green landscape closer to the camp. Here and there, range-slim burner boys black and dark with soot. They wear rags tied over their faces as they douse heaps of clothing and trash infected by the malaria outbreak with engine oil. The blazes choke the sky with cancerous black veins. My brother, Tiran, is out there amidst the stacks, face wrapped like the rest, squinting into a blaze for one token an hour. In the mine, all he wanted to be was a hell diver. It's all any of us wanted to be. I used to sneak downstairs late at night and don my father's work boots and his helmet and sit at the dinner table with forks and spoons pinched between my fingers, acting as if I were running a claw drill. But then my da fell into a pit viper nest and lost his legs. Soon after, Mum died and the rest of da went with her. I used to think my world permanent, that clansmen and women would always tip their heads to my father, that my mother would always be there to wake me and give me a spot of syrup before school. But that life is gone. More miners are lured up every day by the promise of freedom, and in their wake the mines are bought by big companies from big cities and manned by robots stamped with a silver heel. Just like ours was. They say we're to receive a share soon as it makes a profit. We've yet to see so much as a half-credit chit. A throaty din rises from Assimilation Camp 121 as I enter its open gates. It's a muck-soaked town of plastic, tin and dog shit. 50,000 of us now in a place meant for 20, with more coming every day. Gloomy squadrons of mosquitoes buzz low over the soup of the streets, searching for meat to suck. All the lads old enough for the free legions have gone to war. And those boys and girls who stay behind work shit jobs for food tokens so the old don't starve. No child dreams of being a hell diver anymore, because in this new world, there are no hell divers left. Chapter 5, Lyria, Camp 121. I make it to my family's hut using the sheeting and wood planks that serve as roads through the mud. I slip under the mosquito netting just as thunder cracks open the sky overhead. Rain pours down, hammering the thin plastic roofs all down the narrow lane. Inside the dry hut, I'm greeted with the thick smell of stew. I set the basket down inside the door. Our home is 5 meters by 7, made of neoplast, stamped with the Star of the Republic, and a tiny little winged heel where the plastic meets the ground. It's separated into 2 small rooms by opaque plastic dividers that fall from the ceiling. The kitchen and living room in the front, the bunks in the back. My sister Ava is hunched over a little solar stove stirring a pot. She glances back at me as I stand panting. "Either you're getting faster or the clouds are getting slower." "Bit of both," I'd say. I rub the stitch in my side and sit down at the little plastic dinner table. "Tiran's still burning." "That he is." "Poor lad's going to get drenched. Bloody damn, it smells kind in here." I inhale the scent of stew. Ava glows. A bit of garlic found its way into the pot. "Garlic? How'd that sneak through Lambda? They stop hoarding the new freight." "No," she goes back to stirring the pot. "One of the soldiers gave it to me." "Gave? Out of the goodness of his high heart." "And that's not all." She hikes up her skirt to show off 2 brilliant blue shoes. Not government issue clogs. Real shoes of leather and quality rubber. "Bloody damn, what you give him in return?" I ask in shock. "Nothing," Ava scrunches her nose at the accusation. Men don't give gifts for nothing. I'm married. She crosses her arms. Sorry, forgot, I say with bite. Her husband, Varen, is as good a man as I've ever met, and as absent a one. He, along with our two eldest brothers, Angus and Dagon, volunteered for the Free Legions right after we entered the camp. Last we heard from them was from a Legion comm bank on Phobos. Three of them crowded together to fit into the frame. Said they were sailing with the White Fleet toward Mercury. Seems just yesterday I was following Angus through the vents of Lagolos to look for fungus to fill his still. Where are the boys? I ask. Liam's at the infirmary. Again, a pang of pity goes through me. Another ear infection, she says. Could you go visit him in the morning? You know how much... Course, I interrupt. Liam, her second youngest, is just past six and has been blind from birth. He's always been my favourite. Sweet little thing. I'll bring him some leftover candy if the other rats don't gobble it up. You spoil him. Some lads ought to be spoiled. I find my niece Ella bundled up in her carriage by the table. She's playing with a little mobile of one of her brother's broken toys, suspended above her. How's my little Haemanthus blossom on this dreadful stormy eve? I say, poking her nose. She giggles and grabs my finger, then tries to eat it. She got a mouth on her. I'll feed her after dinner. You mind checking Dad's diaper? My father sits in his chair, watching the HC box I stole from a lambda too drunk to mind his tent. His eyes are pearly and distant, reflecting the static of the dead channel that rides on the screen. Let me help you with that, Da, I say. I change the channel till an image of a grav bike shooting over a Mercurian desert appears. Bad men pursue the roguish blue hero who looks not just a bit like Colloway's Z-Char. Is this all right? I ask. Thunder rolls outside. He doesn't answer. Doesn't even look at me. So I bite back the resentment and try to remember him as the man who used to take us to the deep mines. His rough hands would light the gas fire, and he'd whisper ghost stories of Gullback the Dark Creeper or old Shufflefoot in his hoarse voice. The flames from the fire would saw the air, and he would boom out a hilarious laugh at our terrified faces. I don't recognize this man, this creature wearing my father's skin. It just eats and shits and sits there watching the HC. Still, I shove the anger away, feeling guilty for it, and kiss him on the forehead. I tuck his blanket a little bit under his bearded chin and thank the veil there's no soil in his diaper. There's a clatter from the door as my sister's young sons bowl into the house, drenched in mud and rain. Next comes our remaining brother, Tiran, smelling of smoke from the burning stacks. He's the tallest in the family, but frighteningly thin. Most nights he looks like a curled weed hunched over the little books he writes for the children, fills them with stories of castles and veils and flying knights. He whips his wet hair at us and tries to give Ava a hug. My sister shows off her shoes to her jealous boys with false modesty. They debate what one of the brighter blue colours on the tongues ought to be called while I set the dishes. Cerulean, they decide, like Colloway C. Char's tattoos. Colloway C. Char, Colloway C. Char, Tiran mocks. Warlocks, the best pilot in the world, Con says in indignation. Tiran scoffs. I'd take the Reaper in a star shell against Char in a ripwing any day. Con puts his arms on his hips. You're stupid. Warlock would blast him to bloody bits. Well, they're friends, so they won't be blasting each other to anything, my sister says. They're too busy protecting your father and uncles, aren't they? Do you think Da has met them? Con asks. Char and the Reaper. And Ares, Barlow adds. Or Wolfguard the White Tooth? He slams his hands like he's a menacing obsidian. Or Dancer of Faron? Or Thraxa? Aye, they're probably the best of friends. Now eat. We eat dinner huddled around the plastic table as the rain drums the roof. There's barely enough room for bowls and elbows, but we layer around the thin soup and chatter on about the merits of rip wings against star shells in atmosphere. My sister smiles when the boys say the soup tastes better today. After dinner, we gather around with Da to watch one of his programs. I break half of a Cosmos chocolate bar into 7 pieces to share. I pocket my piece for Liam and smile when I see Tyrion give his piece to Ava. No wonder he's so skinny. The program is a news show. The host, a violet, who reminds me a bit of the Helions, a tropical bird that lives off our trash. He has an incredible shock of white hair and a jaw you could carve granite with, but pathetically delicate hands for a man. The very important man is reporting on the Reaper's triumph in Hyperion City. My nephews all nudge each other as he theorises that the next push will be toward Venus to finish off the Ash Lord and his daughter, the Last Fury, once and for all. My sister watches in silence, stroking her new shoes. So far, our brothers and her husband have not been named in the casualty report that scrolls along the bottom of the hollow. Tyrion leans toward the far-off world. He's always been the softest of our family and the most eager to prove himself. Soon it'll be his turn. He becomes 16 in just a few months. Then he'll leave all this mud behind for the stars. I can't help but resent him already. None of them should have left their family. The boys don't see my sister's quiet desperation. The images of the HC dance in their red eyes. The colour, the spectacle of the triumph on Luna, the glory of the greatest son of Red standing with his gold wife, the sovereign who promised us so much, lifting his clenched fist into the air as they howl. They think they could rise like the Reaper. They're too young to see our life is the lie behind the lights. Reaper! Reaper! The crowd shouts. My little nephews join in the chant, and I reach for my sister's hand, glaring at the HC, remembering the promises undelivered, and wonder if I'm the only one who misses the mines. I wake in the night to a distant roar. The room is still. Sweat slicks my legs. I sit up in bed, listening. There's a clamour in the distance, the snoring of far-off engines. Mosquitoes buzz outside the netting that's wrapped around our bunks. Aunt Lyria, Con whispers from beside me. What's that noise? Quiet, love. I strain to hear. The engines fade. I push my legs off the edge of my bunk. Father's soft breathing comes from below. He's still asleep. My sister's bunk is empty. So is Tyrion's sleeping pallet on the ground. I slip past the mosquito netting and out of my bed in shorts and a cotton shirt, soggy from the humidity. Where are you going? Con asks. Aunt Lyria! I seal the netting behind me with the adhesive strip. Just going to take a peek, love, I say. Go back to sleep. I slip on my sandals and leave the room. My sister is already awake, standing near the door and watching nervously as Tyrion puts on his boots. What's that? I ask quietly. Thought I heard a ship.
Probably just some idiot S.O.R. airhead buzzing the camp,
Tyrion says. Not bloody likely, I snap. We ain't had a supply ship land in a month. Lower your voice, he hisses. The little ones'll hear. Well, if you weren't being thick, I wouldn't have to shout. Stop it, you two, Ava looks nervous. What if it's the Red Hand? Tyrion brushes his tangled hair from his eyes. Don't get your fry suit in a twist. The Hand's hundreds of clicks south. Republic wouldn't let anyone in our airspace. Like that means piss all, I mutter. They own the skies, he replies, like he's a praetor. They don't even own their own cities, I say, remembering the bombings in Aegea. He sighs. I'll go take a look. You both mind the house. Mind the house? I laugh. Stop acting the maggot. I'm coming with. No, you're not, Tyrion replies. I'm just as fast as you. Not the bloody point. I'm the man of the house, he says, and I snort. Remember what happened to Vanna, Torin's daughter. Girls shouldn't wander the township at night, especially not us. He means Gamma, and he's right. I knew Vanna since I was a child. She was tattered flesh when they found her, hands cut off. We buried her by the tree line of the jungle south of the camp. Besides, if I'm wrong, you gotta be here to help Ava and the little ones. I'll go take a look and I'll be back fast like, I promise. He leaves without another word. Ava closes the door behind him. She wrings her hands and sits at the kitchen table. I sit down with her, picking at the scratches on the plastic top in irritation. Man of the house. Slag this, I stand up. I'm going to go have a look. Tyrion's already gone. Please, his balls have barely dropped. I'll be back in a tick. I head to the door. Lyria.
What?
She grabs our lone frying pan from the kitchen. At least take this. In case I find eggs?
Fine, fine. I take the pan. Might want to get water and food ready just in case.
She nods, and I leave her behind. The night is grim and humid as air in a smoker's mouth. By the time I've made it out of Gamma Township and into the main camp, a tongue of sweat licks down the small of my back. It's quiet but for the hissing insects. A withered Gaboon lizard watches me from the roof of a refugee domicile as it chews on a night moth. Lights glow from the far end of the camp where the landing pads lie. Eyes glint out from plastic doorways as I pass, peering out from behind mosquito netting. The streets are empty. I'm afraid in a way I never was in the mines, feeling smaller now than I did in our hut. Three men's voices arguing ahead. I creep carefully forward till I'm crouched behind a stack of discarded cargo containers. Two rusty Pelican transport vessels have landed on the concrete pads. One is painted with the face of a lithe pink model drinking a bottle of Ambrosia, a sweet pepper cola beverage that's given half the camp cavities. She smiles and winks at me, her mouth full of white, gleaming teeth. The lights of the ships blaze in the pre-dawn, silhouetting the group of men from our camp who've woken and gone out to inspect the landed ships. My brother is amongst them, loitering in the back self-consciously. I suddenly feel guilty for snorting when he said, "Man of the house." He's just a boy. My boy. My little brother trying to be big. The clansmen are exchanging words with another group of men who've come down the ship's ramps. These ones are Reds too, but they carry weapons and long bandoliers stocked with ammunition across their bare chests. The new men are asking where to find the Gammas. There's an argument amongst the men from our camp, then one of them is pointing toward our township. Another shoves him, but soon several other men begin to point not just at our homes but toward Tyrion and several others amongst their group. The other men drift away from my brother and the three other Gammas. The smallest of the men from the ship says something, but I don't catch it. One of the Gammas rushes him just as the man lifts a long dark object from his side.
acid green light churns in the ammunition globe of his plasma rifle, then lunges from the muzzle in a rippling ball that gashes the darkness. It cleaves clean through the centre of the man. He teeters to the ground like a township drunk. I'm frozen to the spot. My brother flees with the other pair of gammas. One of the outsiders raises his rifle. Metal chatters like a broken silk threading machine. My brother's chest erupts. The other gunmen shatter the quiet night, flashing and bleeding fire from their weapons. Tyrann spasms, jerks, not falling quickly, but stumbling one step, two steps, then another gunshot cracks the air and he is tumbling. Half his head is gone. A wailing cry rises from my belly. The whole world rushes past and goes silent as I stare at the shadowy mound in the mud. Tyrann! The first man to fire walks over to my brother's body and rakes the corpse with the plasma weapon. Then he looks up at me, the acid green fire illuminating a face like a demon's. It's not a man. It's a red woman with terrible scars covering half of her face. Justice to Gamma! Synced to the speakers on both of the ships behind her, her voice bellows out into the night. Death to the collaborators! Justice to Gamma!
Chapter 6. Ephraim, Eternal City. I yawn in the humid dark, craving a burner, because the vapour inhaler I'm sucking on is about as satisfying as fucking through a tarpaulin sheet. My left foot is numb and sweating through the sock in its rubber shoe, and my right arm is bent so awkwardly into the stone that my knock-off Valentu chronometer is drilling into the bone of my wrist with every arterial pulse. The only thing that has kept me sane over the past 9 hours has been the hollow contacts I bought off the rack from that lemur-looking bastard Kobachi on 198th, 56th, and 17th in Old Town. But the contacts shorted out, and now I've got a corneal abrasion and worse, plenty of time to kill. Perfect. I try in vain to stretch. The stone box doesn't give me much room to wriggle my 1.75-metre frame. My main grudge against ancient Egyptians isn't that they pioneered the institution of mass slavery for public works. It's that they were all so damn tiny. Still smells like the old raisin we dragged out of it late last night before the delivery. I checked my watch. It was a gift from my late fiancé. One of the cheap, silvery types cobbled together by half-blind immigrant low-colours in sweatshops deep in the armpits of Luna. Probably Tycho City. Maybe Endymion or the Mass. Somewhere half a world away from the beating heart of Hyperion, where I am currently entombed. He didn't know it was a knock-off, so he paid nearly 60% market value, half his quarterly pay. His face glowed when he gave it to me. I didn't have the heart to tell him. He could have bought it for the price of a decent bottle of vodka. Poor kid. Check the watch again. Almost time. 2 minutes to midnight. Only several hours left of dusk before Hyperion is plunged into the last dark month of summer. Dark or light, a day in Hyperion never truly ends. The caretakers of the day just lock their doors and hand the reins of the town over to the nocturnal creatures. Under gold, it wasn't exactly a pink's paradise. But now, it's the law of the jungle when the lights go out. Outside the museum, the hot city will be stretching and crooning in the sweaty dusk, readying to make some trouble. On the lamplit promenade, decent citizens will skitter to their private housing complexes, fleeing the yapping of young music and the roar of hoverbike gangs echoing up from Lost City. Hyperion, jewel of Luna, the eternal city. She's a beautiful wartime mess. So much to look at, you can only afford to see what you want to see. If you plan on staying sane, that is. But here, in the Hyperion Museum of Antiquities, behind thick walls of marble, is a world with a different set of rules. During day hours, packs of drooling, low-coloured school children and Martian and Terran immigrants waddle their way through the marble corridors, rubbing snotty noses against glass containment boxes. At night, though, the museum is a fortress crypt, impenetrable from the outside, occupied only by a contingent of pale night guards and the dead residents of crypts, statues and paintings. The only way in was to become a resident. So we bribed a docker and snuck aboard a freighter from Earth as it landed at Atlas Interplanetary, a freighter that happened to hold numerous relics liberated from the private stash of some exiled gold overlord, dead or fled to Venus. Probably old Scorpio. Whole slew of goodies. 14 paintings from neoclassical Europe, a crate of Phoenician urns, 25 crates of Roman scrolls, and 4 sarcophagi. What was yesterday filled with mummified Egyptians is tonight filled with freelancers. By now, the janitorial technicians will be herding up their robot charges and moving to the East Wing. A team of security guards occupies a headquarters in the basement. Tick, tock, tick, tock. I'm sick of waiting, sick of the carousel of thoughts in my brain. I stare at the watch, willing the hands forward on their cheap gears that lose seconds every day. Can't think of anything but a ghost and how each tick, each tock, takes me farther from him. Farther from the ridiculous slicked back hair he wore because he thought it made him look like a Hollister I liked, or the knock-off Duvecchi jackets he'd wear, thinking he hid the farm boy underneath. That was his problem. Always trying to be something he wasn't. Always trying to be more. Ate him up in the end and spat him out. I pull my Zolodone dispenser from my pack. I thumb the silver cylinder, and it dispenses a black pill the size of a rat's pupil into my hand. Particularly wicked new designer drug. Absurdly illegal. Jacks up your dopamine and suppresses activity in the bit of grey matter responsible for empathy. Spec Ops teams ate Z's like candy during the Battle of Luna. If you have to melt a city block, it's better to save the tears till you're back in your bunk. I keep the dose low. 1 milligram worth of emotion-numbing molecules lances through my blood. The thoughts of my fiancée lose their dimensionality, becoming nothing but flat, monochrome pictures in a faded memory. Tick, tock, tick, tock. Beep. Shine time. I click my comm once. 3 more clicks echo. Then there's a grating sound from the stone. It begins to move on its own. Blue light from the warehouse overheads seeps through the cracks as the lid of the sarcophagus levitates. A dark mass stands above me, holding the stone lid in the air as if it were made of neoplast. Evening, Volga, I mouth in gratitude to the giant woman. I sit up and feel a series of satisfying pops as my spinal cord stretches. Half my age, my obsidian accomplice smiles with a mouth mangled by second-rate dental work. Unlike ice obsidians, her face is absent the dense wind calluses that usually hide the sloping of cheekbones. Volga's small for an obsidian, lean and a stunted 6.5 feet. It makes her look less threatening than the average crow. It's not what her makers intended. She was born in a lab, courtesy of a society breeding program. poor kid didn't measure up with the rest of the crop and was tossed down to earth for slave labour. Met her 5 years back at a loading dock outside Echo City. I had delivered an item to a collector and had to celebrate with a few cocktails. Volga found me 10 drinks and 2 centimetres deep in a pool of my own blood in an alley, mugged, cut, and left for dead by 2 local blackteeth. She carried me to a hospital, and I paid her back with a ride to Luna, the one place she really wanted to go. Been following me around ever since. Teaching her the trade is my own little pet project. Like me, she wears a black neoplast suit to hide her thermal signature. She's still holding the lid of the sarcophagus above my head in the gloom of the museum's warehouse. "You can stop showing off now," I mutter.
"Do not be jealous, tiny man, that I can lift what you cannot lift."
"Shh! Don't bark so damn loud." She winces.
"Sorry. I thought Sierra turned off the security system."
"Just shut up," I say irritably. "Don't skip in a minefield." The old Legion adage makes me feel even older than does the old ache in my right knee.
"Yes, boss."
She makes an embarrassed face and sets the stone down gently before extending a hand to lift me out. I groan. Even with the Z, I feel every drink and snort and puff of my 46 years. I blame the Legion for stealing a good quarter of them. The Rising for stealing 3 more before I wised up and split. And then myself for spending all the rest like there'd be more coming at the end of the rainbow. I don't need a mirror to tell me I'm the second-hand model of myself. I've got the telltale swollen face of a man who's gone 1 too many rounds with the bottle, and a slight body even a decade in Legion gravity gymnasiums couldn't broaden. I gather the green wrappers from my dinner of sirloin cubes and Venusian ginger seaweed and spray an aerosol can of black market DNA into the sarcophagus before stuffing the can and the garbage into my backpack. Up goes my bodysuit's facial hood, and I motion to Volga to don hers. We find the other 2 members of my team past a stack of crates, 4 metres high, crouched in front of the security door leading out of the warehouse. "Top of the evening," my team's cat, Dano, a young pimply red, says without looking back. "Could hear your knees creaking from 100 metres, tin man. Need some street grease in them. I know a louse at a chop shop who'll do you good." I ignore him and his Terran over-familiarity. I need more Lunese associates. Hell, I'd even take a grumpy Martian. Terrans are all such talkers. My green locksmith, Sierra, another Terran, is on a knee working the interior of the biometric lock. Her gear is set out on the floor near the door, where she'll run support. Bit twitchy, that one. She doesn't usually like coming to the dance floor. I've hired Sierra sporadically over the past few years, but we're not close. She's like most Limeys, petulant and selfish, with a processor in place of a heart. Especially nasty to Volga. Doesn't bother me. I came to the conclusion at the age of 9 that most people are liars, bastards, or just plain stupid. She's a good hacker, and that's all I care about. There's few enough of them freelancing these days. Corporations, criminal and reputable alike, are gobbling up all the talent. But Sierra and Dano are short, and the only way to tell them apart in their hooded black bodysuits is a sizable paunch around Sierra's midsection. That, and the fact that Dano is doing the splits, stretching for his part in the play, and humming an asinine red ditty to himself. I mind Dano less than Sierra. I've known him since he was a street rat, fresh off the boat from Earth, pickpocketing on the promenade with more acne on his face than hair on his head. Sierra's hands work the innards of the door, her left holding an output jack that transmits a wireless signal from the door to the hardware in her head. Two metal crescents packed with hardware and two hardline uplinks embedded in her skull run from her temples, over her ears, and back toward the base of her cranium. I see their bulge from underneath her thermal hood. Door alarm? I ask when she leans back from the door. Off, obviously, she snaps, voice muffled through the hood. The magnetic seal is dead. She glances over at Volga, who has kneeled to unfold her compact assault rifle from its black case. Planning to break your rule tonight, Crow? Wait, are we murder positive? Dano asks eagerly. No, we're not breaking any rules, I reply. But if chance strikes, the Pale Lady is my walking, talking insurance policy. You know what they say. Hell hath no fury like a woman packing a railgun. Volga's gloved hands assemble the black weapon. She pulls free three curved clips of ammunition and attaches them to the outside of her suit with bonding tape. Each clip is marked with a coloured band, coordinating with the type of projectile. Venom paralytic, electrical disruptor, hallucinogenic round. Never killing rounds. Damn inconvenient having a killing machine bodyguard who refuses to kill. I've no such reservations. I touch the pistol on my own hip, making sure the leg holster is tight. Muscle reflex by this point. I look back at Sierra. You going to make me ask about the rest of the alarms? Limey couldn't get all of them, Dano says from the ground where he contorts his leg behind his head in a bizarre hamstring stretch. That right? Yeah, Sierra mutters. Dano looks over at me, his face hidden behind the tight black plastic of his thermal. Told you, we should have hired Geratrix. Geratrix is syndicate now, I mutter. Dano bows his head in mock sorrow. Another one for the bloody black. It's not my fault, Sierra says in a low voice. They updated their system. New protocols are government. Would take me nearly 30 minutes to punch in. Shit, it'd take a team of Republic astral hackers at least 12. I hold up a hand. Hear that? I whisper. They listen. That's the sound of your take getting cut in half. Half? Half a job, half pay. Sierra's got a temper on her, as short as a tick's tooth. Her hand drops to the multigun on her hip. Still, Volga takes one step toward her, and Sierra looks like a kitten hearing thunder. I bend on a knee in front of the green. It's not my fault, she says. I take her chin through the mask and guide it so she's looking at me. Calm down and tell me the problem. I snap my fingers. Today, pissant. I can't access the Conqueror's exhibit systems, she admits. At all? It's on an isolated server. Real relics in there, real security. I feel a spasm of annoyance in my left eyelid. Damn. Dano's going to have to do some acrobatics. You know how I hate surprises, Sierra. Told you we should have bought the grav belts, Dano says. Say, I told you we shoulda one more time. See what happens. He meets my eyes, then glances down at the floor. Thought so. Spider gloves are good enough, I say. Recyclers on. Dano, Volga, and I pull our recyclers from our bags and strap them over our thermals' mouth holes. I trust you still have the doors figured. She nods. 30 seconds in each room, I remind them, as Volga slings her gun on her back and approaches the door. Dano rolls up from his stretch and Volga pushes a large flat magnet against the door. It makes a dull thump as it locks onto the metal. We stir at the magnet as its sound reverberates. Through the door, our voices won't be heard, but that might have been. I look to Sierra. She shakes her head. Decibel levels were too low. Clear. Volga wraps her massive mitts around the handle. My body welcomes the adrenaline, sucking it down like water on cracked asphalt. I look at the watch and feel nothing. My focus narrows to the here and now. I grin. No one better sprain their fucking ankle, I say, warming up my legs. Go on, V, shine time. Volga heaves on the door, rolling it back into the wall. And grid one is down, Sierra says quietly into our comms. Dano goes first into the hall, on sound-dampening shoes. I go next and look to see if Volga's following. She's right behind me, freakishly silent despite her size. Sierra stays behind, monitoring the security systems and the guard level. Down a narrow staff corridor lies another heavy security door.
Hold, Sierra says. Grid 2 is down. 29, 28.
Volga puts a mechanical lever under the door and activates it. The heavy door slides upward, jolting along with the lever. We shimmy under the door. A painting of a furious warhorse strapped to a chariot is suspended mid-stride from the ceiling. In the chariot is an archer firing at men in bronze armour and horsehair helms. I stand quickly to look around the vast room. Weeping stone children peer down from the floral columns. Great frescoes explode with colour along marble walls. Soon, the floor pressure sensors, cameras and lasers will come back on. 20? A sense of nostalgia sweeps over me as we run across the floor. Seems just yesterday I was here as a Legion pledge. I remember boarding the tram to come to the city centre, wearing the winged pyramid pin they give us, puffing my chest out when high colours would nod to me or low colours would step out of my path. Stupid kid. He thought that pin made him a man. It just made him a pet. And nowadays, it'll get you scalped. 8, 7. After 3 more hauls and a stitch in my side later as I try to keep up with my younger crew, we reach the Conqueror's exhibit, where we prop open the door with the lever and shimmy under. Carefully, we stand on a narrow slip of metal, just shy of the marble floor that has the inbuilt pressure sensors. The room is as domineering as its subjects, built by enraptured Gauls to honour their psychotic ancestors who conquered Earth. It is grand and brutal, and unchanged by the Republic except for a few modifications. They've included a list of the conquered amongst the conquerors. Representations of pre-colour humans stand beside casualty statistics. 110 million died for gold to rule. Then their bombers dropped Solocene into the troposphere and neutered an entire race. Didn't even have to convert them to the colour hierarchy. Just had to wait a century for them to die out. Bloodless genocide. Give one thing to the conquerors. They were efficient. Pricks. At the centre of the exhibit, under a stone archway with the legend Conqueror's Exhibit, 20 ancient Ionic columns line an ascending stairway. At the top, a Delphic temple sits, and inside that, past priceless relics encased in duroglass, lies the object of my collector's desire. It's a sword of the first overlord, a razor belonging to the great bastard, hero of the conquerors, Silenius Orlune, the Lightbringer. That don't look so scary, Dano said when we first got the contract. I smiled and nodded to Volga. What if she were holding it? She looked scary waving a bloody damn muffin. If I had a muffin, I would eat it, Volga said. The blade sits behind 2 fingers of duroglass and is on loan to the museum from a private collector for only 1 week longer. Liberation Day is a perfect time for it to go missing. Volga and I scan the ceiling of the exhibit, looking for the telltale sign of a drone garage. We see it In the top left corner of the room, a small titanium flap built into the marble. I nod to Volga, and she slips on her spider gloves and jumps onto the wall. They stick to the marble, and she crawls along the wall till she's hanging beneath the garage door. She pulls four laser nodes from her pack and puts them on either side of the door and activates them. Two green lasers crisscross over the door. She gives me an eager thumbs up and looks for more garages. I nudge Dano. He's up. The boy does an ironic two-step dance on the narrow slip of the doorframe, jumps up onto the wall with his spider gloves, then pushes off with his legs, backflipping onto a glass case, holding a gold war helmet. He catches himself, turns, then leapfrogs case to case till he can jump onto one of the ionic columns. He hits it midway up, hugs it, and shimmies up. As he moves, I summon the autoflyer from its garage 5 clicks away via my datapad. It drives autonomously through traffic toward the museum. Dano moves along the columns like some sort of human flea till he's picked his way directly above the glass case. He lets himself fall, turning in the air so he lands on all fours in a way that makes my knees ache just to watch. Dano stands and delivers an obnoxious bow before pulling his laser cutter from his pack. The glass glows as he cuts a circular hole into it. Then, with a triumphant smile, he plucks up the blade and holds it aloft. The alarm goes off on schedule. A high-pitched frequency screams out of speakers. It would shred our eardrums if we didn't have sonic plugs. As it is, it's little more than the annoying whine of a hungry dog. A second security door closes behind us, sealing us in. 2 nodes on the ceiling lower and begin to pump disabling gas into the room. Does nothing with our recyclers running. Up high on the wall, the drone garage opens and a metal drone rips out of its hiding place right into Volga's laser grid. It smokes down to the floor in 4 pieces. A second follows and meets the same fate as she shoots out the cameras. At the windows, metal security doors fall to block us in. I stand still like a conductor at the center of his orchestra. All these variables falling into place just as I planned, and a deep, formless depression falls on me as the adrenaline fades. "Locksmith, find your exit," I mutter into my comm. Volga drops from her place on the wall to join me. She moves excitably, still young enough to be impressed by this. Dano hops along the columns back to the arch where he graffitis profanity with his laser drill. "The razor?" I ask. He twirls it in his hand. It's meant for a man twice his size. "A nasty little dick tickler." "The razor," I say again. "Course, boss." He flips it to me casually. I snag it out of the air. His handle is too big for my hand. Real ivory exterior and inlaid with gold filigree. The rest is brutally economical. In whip form, it coils like a thin sleeping snake. Eager to be rid of it, I shove it in a foam carry case and tuck it into my pack. "All right, kids." I open the canister of custom acid and tip it onto the marble floor. "Time to go." Chapter 7. Ephraim, the Arbiter. The morning after the heist, on my least favourite day of the year, I drain the vodka from a glass, waiting for the Arbiter to finish his inspection. "So, is there a verdict yet?" I ask, without bothering to hide my impatience. The slender man makes a show of remaining silent at the desk over which he has been hunched for the better part of an hour. It's overdramatic white slush. Anemic assholes think it profound to feign an air of aloofness, hiding behind contracts and commerce the way spiders hide and wait behind their webs. 200 were sentenced to life in deep grave during the Hyperion trials for their part in the gold judicial system. Should have been 10,000. Rest were saved by the amnesty declared by the sovereign. Bored, I survey the rest of the penthouse. It's painfully tasteful, done up in the restrained ostentation popular in Luna's upper circles. Minimalist decor with rose quartz floors and large windows that look out over the glowing nightscape. On a moon where 3 billion souls clamour atop each other to breathe, only the offensively rich can afford to waste space. It reminds me of so many of the decadent flats I encountered as a high-end claims investigator for Piraeus Insurance before the Rising, back when I was the help. High colours look down on greys because we took out the trash. Low colours hated us because they were the trash. Everyone else feared us. Because for 700 years, we have been the all-purpose knife of the state. Obsidians? Circus freaks, a lot of them. Greys do work. We are adaptable, efficient, and bred for systematic loyalty. Little has changed for most of them. New masters, same collar. I yawn. I'm thinking too much again, so I pop a Zolidone. Stand and pace as the drug leads my wandering thoughts back to my employer with a cold, distant hand. Oslo, if that is in fact his name, is an inoffensive, impossibly meticulous creature with a dreadful sense of calm that borderlines on the robotic. Slender and professional in his white business tunic with a starched high collar and sleeves to his knuckles. His skin is squid ink black. His head bald, and the irises of his eyes an unsettling white. He adjusts the digital monocle on his right eye. "I do believe this is the item my clients requested," he says, in a harmonic baritone. "As I said, can we wrap this up?" He leans closer to the blade one last time before straightening and sheathing it very carefully into a gel-insulated metal briefcase. "Citizen Horn, as ever, you delivered the requested item in a timely manner." Oslo turns back to me, typing into his datapad. "You will note that the agreed-upon sum has been deposited into your Echo City account." I pull up my own datapad to check. His right eyebrow goes up. "I trust everything is satisfactory." "Yut," I mutter. "Yut," he says in curiosity. "Oh, yes, Legion speak." Denoting an affirmation, usually done to convey affirmative sarcasm to a disliked officer. "It's called dog tongue," I say. "Not Legion speak." "Of course," he touches his chest. "In fact, I studied it extensively. I suppose you could say I'm a bit of a military enthusiast. The traditions, the organization. Merriwater ad portas," he says with a smile, using the phrase that 7 centuries of legionnaires have shouted in memory of John Merriwater, the American who almost turned the tide of the conquering by invading Luna, a reminder that the enemy is always at the gate. I let it go, reminded of something the Ashlord said to my cohort as a valedictory speech. "Those you protect will not see you, they will not understand you, but you are the grey war between civilization and chaos, and they stand safe in the shadow you cast. Do not expect praise or love. Their ignorance is proof of the success of your sacrifice. For we who serve the state, duty must be its own reward." Or something like that. Good branding. Works like a charm on 16-year-old grey matter. "Now, what's next on your mysterious employer's list?" I ask. "The Sword of Alexander, the Magna Carta, the blackened heart of Cthulhu Moon. I know, the knickers of the sovereign herself, if she wears any. There will be nothing else. Between you and me, I doubt she was..." "Wait, what?" "There will be nothing else, Citizen Horn," Oslo says, picking up the briefcase containing the razor. "Nothing?" "Correct. My client has found this business relationship most satisfactory. But this piece will be the final acquisition, completing their collection. Thusly, we will conclude our affiliation. Your services will not be required in the future. Well, my bank account's sorry to see you go, I say, feeling a nasty hollowness, knowing no job is waiting in the wings. It's the first time in 3 years I've not had one on deck. But nothing good can last forever, eh? I stand and offer my hand to the taller wight. He shakes it gently and I hold on. The platinum rings on my forefinger dig into his tissue-thin skin. So you're still not even going to give me a hint about who I've been stealing for all this time? He jerks his hand away, and I narrow my eyes at him. Just a hint. Oslo stares at me intensely. Why did curiosity kill the cat? He asks me. Is telling riddles part of the job requirement? He smiles. Because the cat stumbled upon the anaconda. I linger in the suite after Oslo has left, long enough to dull the bitterness of his words with a couple more glasses of vodka. Out the window, my city of towers writhes. She looks prettier in the dark. Idly, I cycle through the contents of my address book, looking for a distraction. It's a sea of detritus, bodies I've explored, relationships I've stretched past fraying, and floating amidst that wretched digital sea, standing in front of the city that never sleeps, surrounded by a billion breathing mouths, I feel the dark creep of despair. I pour one last drink, willing the numbness to spread. Half day later, after a nap and a sobering plate of Terran noodles, I meet my crew to disperse the funds, though I hardly feel like company on account of the date. They're huddled in a booth in an uppity South Promenade bar on the fringe of Old Town, drinking vibrantly coloured cocktails. Volga twirls a pink umbrella between massive fingers. The bar itself is located inside the gutted carcass of an old advertising dirigible that someone renovated in an attempt to commercialise irony. Seems to be working, despite the wartime rationing. The place buzzes with soldiers, packs of slick, suited silvers, new moneyed greens and coppers, all the ones near the right levers to make cash when the free market opened, now surrounded by the gaggles that attend them like brightly plumed vultures. It's mostly mid-colours, and there's been more than a few nervous glances aimed at Volga. The big girl has ordered me something called a Venusian Fury. It's dark as its namesake, Atlantia algrimus, and tastes like licorice and salt. Something in it makes the back of my eyes buzz and my groin swell. What do you think? She asks, hopefully. Tastes like the ass end of the Ash Lord. I push it away. She looks downcast at the table. In my haze, pity is slow to come, and dull when it does. I hate bars like this. You know what the Ash Lord's ass tastes like? Sierra asks. Look how old he is, Dano says, taking a break from staring at a beautiful slip of a pink at the bar, who looks nervously at his nasal piercings. His head is buzzed in popular fashion with obsidian dragons. Tin pot's been around long enough to try everything. I don't reply, trying to hold on to the buzz left over from Oslo's vodka. I'll need it where I'm going. Whose idea was this commercial shithole? I ask. Not mine, Dano says, holding up his hands. Not nearly enough bare tits in this place. It was mine, Sierra says defensively. It was featured in Hyperion Weekly. You know, F, it is humanly possible to enjoy something different, something new. New generally means someone's just trying to make money off something old. Whatever. It's Better than the black old dives you visit to pickle your liver. At least here I'm not worried about getting an infection just by walking in the door. Let's get this over with. I pull up my data pad so they can all see, and transfer the funds into each of their accounts. Sure, they'd see the balances change on their own pads if I'd just done it over the net, but there's something incredibly human and satisfying for them to see my thumb disperse the money. All done, I say. 600 apiece. Even for Limey? Dano asks. Thought she was getting half. What the hell does it matter to you? Sierra snaps. The rest of us did our jobs without a bloody hitch. He goes back to looking at the pink girl, who's talking with her friends. No reason we shouldn't get a little bonus for that action. I need no bonus, Volga says. Dano sighs. You ain't helping the cause, love. What the shit is your damage? Sierra glares at Dano, past Volga, between them. Always jacking on about my business. Why don't you tend your own and focus on catching diseases from pink slips? I lurch to my feet. All right, this was fun, trying not to catch anything. And he's out like a Drachenjäger. Dano checks his newest shiny chronometer. This one has rubies embedded in the hands. 2 minutes flat. When's the next job? Sierra asks. Yeah, boss, Dano says. When's the next job? Sierra's got bills to pay. She flips him the crux and stares at me with more desperation than she probably means to show. It's pitiful. So, your man's got another job, right? Not this time. We're all done. What do you mean? What I said. Seeing rain slithering down the windows, I pop the collar of my jacket. Ephraim, Volga says plaintively, you just arrived. Stay for a drink. We can order you something else. She stares up at me with those big, mopey eyes, and for a moment I consider it until I hear a telltale hush of the patrons and turn to see two towering figures emerge from outside through the dirigible's metal door. Goals. They wear black jackets with legion epaulets, their shoulders eclipsing the heads of the other patrons. They blithely survey the room with entitled eyes before one of them catches sight of Dano's pink and strides to the bar. The others make room, and he introduces himself without a care in the world. There's an iron griffin pin on his chest. Arcos Spawn. Dano's eyes go down as the gold's hand drifts to the pink's waist. Boss, Dano says, eyeing me warily. I realize my hand has drifted to the butt of the pistol under my jacket. Bloody damn Oriot. We should have purged a lot of them, or exiled them to the core. But that chance is gone. All for the war effort. Just one drink, Ephraim, Volga says plaintively. It will be fun. We can tell each other stories and share jokes as friends do. It's always the same story. As I leave the dirigible in the grav lift, the warm laughter of one of the gold youths chases me down into the night.